Welcome, welcome, welcome to Jerry Roach's podcast. In this first installment, we'll be going through my book, Northern Heights, Climbing North America's Highest Peaks. Of course, we will start with the highest. Chapter 1, Touching Greatness, Denali, 1963. Part 1. Welcome to Talkeetna. The Alaska Railroad conductor broke our reverie by barking, "Talkeetna, you boys got 3 minutes to unload that stuff. We have a schedule." We jumped to the task as if a grizzly bear were upon us, rolled open the boxcar door, and propelled our gear into the rain. As fast as our four pairs of hands shoveled the gear out the door, a single pair of hands caught and stacked it outside the train. Counting as we heaved, I hollered to my teammates, 19, 20, 21, all pieces accounted for, everybody out. We hopped into the mud and the train rumbled off immediately. The pair of hands that had sanctioned this mayhem belonged to Don Sheldon. We were eager to meet this famous Alaskan bush pilot who was already a living legend. Even in 1963, the stories about Sheldon's heroic mountain flying feats preceded him. He was a short man with black hair, a perpetual twinkle in his eye, and an Eskimo appearance accentuated by his trademark parka with a fur ruff. We took a deep breath, but Sheldon was way ahead of us, greeting us with, "Yowza! You're the track team from Colorado, you betcha!" Too eager, I blurted out, "When can we fly in? This weather doesn't look so good." Chuckling, Sheldon replied, "Patience, lad. The McGowan party waited 10 days for good flying weather." While we groaned about this bad news, Sheldon backed his battered old truck up to our pile of gear, dropped the tailgate, and said, "Use this rig and run your stuff over to my hangar. That's where you'll be staying. Don't worry, men. The weather has gone ape, but this just looks like a 3-day blow. I gotta go to Anchorage, you bet." 3 minutes later, Sheldon's plane roared overhead. We hustled over to Sheldon's red-roofed hangar just as the June rain doubled in intensity. It drummed on the hangar's tin roof as if God had released a bag of celestial marbles. Dick looked at our soggy, muddy clothing and shouted over the din, "Ha! We've been here 5 minutes and we already need a shower and a laundry." Mike replied, "Hey, buddy, in Colorado we don't do those things." Joff added, "You betcha, oh clean one." Trying to slow my companions down a little, I summarized with, "Welcome to Talkeetna, lads." Smirking, Dick regained his composure, grabbed his raincoat, and said, "Okay, you Colorado hotshots. I'm from Seattle, where it rains all the time. We never break stride for a little rain, so I'm going out to explore the town. Would you thin-clads care to join me? I know Jerry will." We rose as one and marched into the rain. We quickly explored tiny Talkeetna, which carried an Athabascan Indian name meaning "where the rivers meet." Main Street ran for 3 long blocks from the train tracks to the Susitna River. The town runway went from the Susitna River past Sheldon's hangar, across Main Street, and right up to the Fairview Inn, which held a soggy, limp windsock. Wet enough, we returned to the hangar and examined Sheldon's yellow 2-person Super Cub with its retractable skis. We would fly into the mountain in this plane. External exploration over, we paced the hangar's sagging plank floor, and near one of Sheldon's workbenches found a suitable bar for doing chin-ups. Naturally, we immediately had a contest. Mike, as fit and crazed as ever, won with 20. I got second with 16. Dick managed 14 and Joff 12. Nothing had changed. I couldn't even beat Mike in a chin-up contest. As the rain continued to drum on the roof, I fell into a reverie about how the four of us had arrived in Talkeetna together to climb Denali. 2. Synergy. Athabascan Indians living in Alaska's interior, north of the mountain, called it Denali. For them it was simply the High One, the Great One. They understood. Take your modern notions of what a mountain is, toss them out, and start over. Denali is higher, bigger, colder, stormier, more dangerous, difficult, and beautiful than you can imagine. White men originally named the mountain McKinley, but he is still the Great One. Denali rises to a hard-to-visualize 20,320 feet above the sea, and is, by a large margin, the highest mountain in North America. Many South American and Himalayan mountains surpass Denali's height, but those mountains all start higher and are at much more temperate latitudes. Denali rises at 63 degrees north latitude and is Earth's highest peak north of 45 degrees north latitude. Denali is also higher than any peak south of 45 degrees south latitude. Denali reigns over half of Earth's surface, the polar half. Not only is Denali a high mountain and a northern mountain, it is a big mountain. Denali's huge mass is difficult to understand when you first see it from a distance. Central Alaska is mostly flat, with elevations ranging from near sea level to a few thousand feet. Denali soars nearly 4 miles above this vast flatness. In Talkeetna, 60 miles south of Denali, the elevation is a few hundred feet. At Wonder Lake, 30 miles north of Denali, the elevation is 2,000 feet. On the Peters Glacier, at the base of Denali's Great Wickersham Wall, less than 7 miles from the summit, the elevation is still only 5,000 feet. Denali's thrust above its base is most of its height. When you try to compare Denali to other mountains, you will likely fail. What appears to be a small mark in the slope turns out to be an ice cliff 300 feet high. Vague undulations in the glacier surface hide crevasses 30 feet wide and 200 feet deep. Your eye will measure a slope by how long you think it will take you to climb it, but a slope that you measure in hours will probably take the same number of days to climb. Everything is much farther than it looks. If God turned Denali upside down, it would be 4 times as deep as the Grand Canyon, with walls, spires, and twisting canyons ravaging the earth in an astonishing dimension. Denali is not just a peak, it's a region. Denali's weather is usually bad. The Gulf of Alaska is one of the Northern Hemisphere's best breeding grounds for low-pressure systems, and these Gulf storms spin freely across the water before driving their moisture inland to Denali. Killer storms can rage unabated for days, and occasionally they roar for a week or more. Denali's rugged terrain spawns 6 major glaciers and dozens of complex cirques. Denali is a vast arena of snow, ice, cold, storm, and unrivaled beauty. Denali's magic first fingered me in 1953 when I was 9 years old. I went to a slideshow about a successful ascent of Denali's Muldrow Glacier route on the northeast side of the peak. It was cloudy when the team arrived at Wonder Lake, and as the speaker showed a picture of heavy clouds hovering over the tundra, he hung his head and droned, "We were deeply disappointed that we couldn't see the breathtaking view of Denali." Then, lifting his head, he said, "But it started to clear, and we saw the mountain." I eagerly awaited the next slide. When it appeared, it showed clouds lifting like a curtain to reveal a craggy peak. Brightening further, the speaker pointed to the peak and said enthusiastically, "There it is!" He paused dramatically, eyed his audience, and said evenly, "Then we realized that this peak was only a foothill. Denali was up." His finger moved slowly up the screen into the clouds. At the very top of the screen was a hole in the clouds, and through the hole I saw a sunlit slope covered with crevasses. Denali! The effect was dramatic, and I gasped along with everybody else in the audience. The next few slides revealed the monumental mountain as it continued to clear. Finally, Denali stood sovereign and impossibly high above the foothill that I had mistaken for the Great One. To be captured by Denali's magic is easy, but to climb it is something else. Real understanding of this noble peak is something else again. Denali's magic probed me for an opening in 1953 when that finger moved up the screen. In 1963, I was 19, keen, fit, strong, and eager, but my zeal was way ahead of both my experience and understanding. However, the magic had found a route and had seeped deep. I had to touch the Great One. I was in Talkeetna with my climbing partner, Joff Wheeler. University students had called the two of us the Squirrels, but we steadfastly called ourselves the Summit Club. After 4 years, we had made many technical ascents on the rock crags near Boulder, stretched our limits on long peaks east face, and climbed Shiprock in New Mexico. We had also climbed many high peaks in Colorado and in Wyoming's Tetons. To add an international flair, we made ascents of Mexico's high volcanoes, including Mexico's highest peak, 18,701-foot Orizaba. Joff and I recruited Mike McCoy, who was one of our track team chums. Mike brought as much passion to the starting line of a race as Leighton Koehr brought to the base of a climb. At the start of the big cross-country meets, our team lined up five deep with the fastest runner, Mike, in front. Mike was so excited that we had to hang on to him to keep him from disqualifying the whole team by sprinting off before the gun. I hollered at him, "You gotta hold it in, Mike." At the state meet, we almost ripped his shorts off trying to keep him on the line, and we all ran very well that day. With Mike on board, I returned to Seattle, where I had no trouble recruiting my roommate, Dick Springate, and we quickly had a team of four. Dick had grown up in Seattle, and he quickly introduced me to climbing in the Cascades. When the weekend came, we always went climbing, rain or shine. With this tactic, we didn't have to understand the vagaries of the storm fronts that continually battered the Pacific Northwest. Usually it rained, but we still managed to make our summit most of the time. We did research on the mountain, pooled our meager resources, bought used equipment, and called in some favors until our preparations became a frenzied fever. When June finally arrived, Joff and Mike drove Mike's battered station wagon from Boulder to Anchorage, while Dick and I flew from Seattle. 3. Sheldon's Wager with the Wind. The rumble of Sheldon's returning plane abruptly broke my reverie. We chased after him, but Sheldon zipped across the runway, disappearing before we could reach him. Chuckling, we returned to our Talkeetna Hilton and plotted new strategies for catching up with Sheldon. It rained for the next 3 days, but nevertheless, Sheldon was never in sight for more than 10 minutes, so we thought of our questions before he reappeared. Then, when he walked into the hangar, we fell in step and fired away. He was always going somewhere and seemed to be in the air more than he was on the ground. We listened to his plane roar off at 3 a.m., come back at 7 a.m., and blast off again at 8 a.m. In his brief appearances, he said things like, "Gotta go to Anchorage. Gotta run these supplies up the river. Gotta get those fishermen out of camp. You bet." We attached homemade traction plates to our wooden snowshoes with Sheldon's tools. Our system consisted of a metal plate bolted under the snowshoe's wooden cross member, which was just in front of the foot. We hoped the plate would give us better traction on steep slopes. When Sheldon saw our system, he exclaimed, "Skookum! Grousers! Why didn't I think of that? You can go straight up the hill with those grousers. You betcha!" Sheldon's stories of daring, skill, and bravery were often told, but Sheldon never told his own tales. He was too modest and always off making another story. In February 1954, Sheldon flew his Super Cub through heavy clouds and located the wreckage of an Air Force C-47 that had crashed 60 miles north of Talkeetna. He dropped a note to three staggering survivors directing them to an open meadow, then landed in oncoming darkness and rising storm. After spending the night with the survivors, he evacuated them one by one the next day. In 1958, he again flew through heavy clouds on Mount Illimana, southwest of Anchorage, looking for a lost C-54 transport plane. The plane carried passengers, Christmas packages, and payroll for the troops at Chimaya Air Force Base. As he approached the active volcano, the wind was ripping and tearing, and his Super Cub jumped like a scared cat. He played his hunches correctly in the swirling clouds and volcanic sulfur fumes, and finally found the wreckage near the summit. This time there were no survivors. Because of the location, the military did not try to recover the bodies. 6 years later, it was Sheldon who stopped a scavenging treasure hunter from plummeting the wreckage. Sheldon took on another daring rescue in 1960. This one was on Denali. John Day, Pete Schoening, and Jim and Lou Whitaker completed a speedy climb of the mountain, but they took a horrendous fall while descending from Denali Pass. They slid at high speed down a long, steep snow slope before stopping at 17,000 feet. The fall seriously injured Day, and the others were in various states of disrepair. Another team from Anchorage had a seriously ill member at 16,400 feet, a woman named Helga Bading. The Anchorage party did what it could for the Day party, but the two stricken teams needed outside help. Sheldon flew over the accident site and, horrified, saw the incinerated wreckage of a Cessna 180. A pilot from Anchorage had crashed in his attempt to aid the climbers. Both the pilot and his passengers were dead. Sheldon dropped emergency supplies to the Day party, then returned to Talkeetna. Several rescue attempts by Army helicopters failed, and the Army grounded their choppers. Sheldon ferried a large rescue team to the Kehiltna Glacier, but the injured climbers were way above them on the upper mountain. John Day was immobile, and Helga Bading's condition worsened. Time was running out. By radio, Sheldon told the Anchorage party that if they could get Helga down to 14,200 feet, he would attempt to land there, even though no one had ever landed that high on Denali. While the climbers struggled down, Sheldon made multiple passes over a tiny patch of smooth snow, trying to decide if it was big enough for a landing. It was minimal, but enough, so Sheldon made the first landing high on Denali and snatched Helga from the mountain. Immediately after landing in Talkeetna, Sheldon refueled his plane and returned to the mountain. This time he flew cover for a plucky helicopter pilot named Link Luckett. Luckett's tiny chopper had a 16,000-foot ceiling, and John Day was at 17,200 feet. So Luckett threw out everything non-essential, put in minimal fuel, started the chopper, then threw the battery out to save every possible ounce. Luckett and Sheldon flew up together to rescue Day. Luckett made three landings at 17,200 feet and relayed the injured climbers down to Sheldon's landing spot at 14,200, and Sheldon flew them out from there. Then, without a break, Sheldon flew out the rescuers, making 18 landings in this unbelievable marathon. Such stories had made Sheldon a living legend. We knew all about the Day-Bodding saga after reading a Life magazine article, which was complete with many gory pictures. We didn't talk about it much, but it struck terror into our hearts. On May 1, 1963, just a month before our departure for Denali, Jim Whitaker had become the first American to climb Mount Everest. The man who had carried the Stars and Stripes to the roof of the world had not been able to complete an ascent and descent of Denali under his own power 3 years earlier. We were trying to climb Denali, not Everest, and this realization only deepened our dread. We resolved to be very careful on the slope below Denali Pass where the Day party had fallen. We knew Sheldon would get us to the mountain when the weather cleared, but when would that happen? We passed the time by practicing our crevasse rescue drill on Sheldon's runway. We roped up, walked down the runway, then at random someone screamed, "Falling! Arg!" The faller pulled crazily on the rope in some unexpected direction, while the other three fell down and controlled the craziness. Once the faller was tethered, the last person zipped forward, set an ice axe on the imaginary crevasse edge, attached a small rope-gripping Prussic knot to the faller's rope, and pulled back with a 2-to-1 mechanical advantage. With one more maneuver, we had a 3-to-1 advantage and sedately pulled our kicking and screaming victim across the runway. We perfected our 3-to-1 drill until it took less than 30 seconds, all the while providing entertainment for the locals. After our fourth day of waiting, a patch of blue showed through the clouds. We immediately tracked Sheldon down, pointed to the patch, and asked if he was ready to go. Without breaking stride, he replied, "Nope, that's just the eye of the storm coming this way. Big wind blowing up there now. Tear the wings right off the cub." Then zoom, he was off to fly a fisherman over the river. When the weather continued to improve, we soared into feverish excitement. This was not a time for analysis, since even our waiting consumed all our energy. We would fly in one at a time in Sheldon's two-seat Super Cub, so we drew straws to determine our order. It ended up Joff, me, Mike, then Dick. We felt sure tonight would be the night. Dozing fitfully at 3 a.m., I heard Sheldon's plane landing. Convinced that he was coming to get us, I lurched out of my sleeping bag and sprinted outside the hangar, while my stomach tied a bowline. Seeing the taxiing plane pushed me over my excitement limit, so I quickly changed course, sprinted around the side of the hangar, and threw up. While I cleaned myself up, the others fell in line with Sheldon, but all he said was, "Nope, gotta let the weather sober up over there, maybe later today." I just muttered, "Oh, blast," since I had been sick for nothing. Finally, on our fifth day, Sheldon surprised us by striding up and saying, "Yowza! Time to huckle the buck on up there, you bet." Then he barked his orders. "Lookee, divide your gear into four equal piles. Make sure that each man has his own sleeping bag, snowshoes, and survival gear. Make sure that the first man has a tent, stove, food, and fuel in case he ends up on the glacier alone. Hike down the runway and cut 50 spruce boughs 3 to 4 feet long. Roll the hangar door back, but don't touch the plane yet. I don't know what to do with your sled. I'll be back in 15 minutes." This really was it, and we flew into frenzied activity. We had plenty to do now, and I controlled my nervous stomach. Sheldon returned on cue and said, "Help me roll the cub out, and let's get her ready." While Dick cut spruce branches, Mike and I helped Sheldon gas the cub. Sheldon carefully filtered the gas through a chamois to eliminate any water, then he washed the cub's plexiglass windshield. Joff put on his mountain clothing and double boots. He looked strangely out of place on the tarmac, but in 1 hour he would be on the Kehiltna Glacier at 7,300 feet. Suddenly we had to adopt a mountain mentality. Hat at the ready? Check. Sunglasses? Check. Camera? Check. Sheldon carefully supervised the loading of the cub. He didn't want the plane to get tail heavy, so he stuck a few light items in the back, along with his own emergency kit. Joff placed his pack on the floor where the passenger seat would have been if it were there, crawled in and sat on his pack. Then we carefully stashed gear around him. We placed a gallon of gas upright in a good spot, 2 5-gallon food cans between Joff's feet and another on his lap. The last moment we passed in a great wad of spruce branches. Sheldon would drop those one at a time over the landing site so he could see the glacier's surface better. Sheldon tied Joff's long trail snowshoes to the wing strut. His own were already there. Finally, Sheldon slipped into the front seat, prepared to pull the two-piece door shut, and said, "I'll be back in about 2 hours. Make sure the second man is ready to go. Blast off, you bet." He fired the engine, watched his gauges come to life, spoke a few words into his radio, and taxied onto the runway. We ran along giving thumbs up and victory signs, but we had packed Joff in so tight that he couldn't wave back. The overloaded cub roared down the runway, and we wondered if it would lift off before crashing into the river. Pulling up in plenty of time, the cub made a slow climbing turn over the river, then headed north toward the mountain. We watched until the tiny plane slipped from our view and its sound faded into the Alaskan wilderness. The next 2 hours seemed like an eternity. I was next. I put on my boots and mountain clothes, then paced around my pile of gear, sweating. If Sheldon came back alone, then Joff was on the glacier and the flight had been a success. If Joff was still on the plane, Sheldon had scrubbed the flight. What if Sheldon didn't come back at all? That was unthinkable, since Sheldon always won his wager with the wind. My stomach started acting up again, but this time Mike paced with me. When I heard the cub returning, my mouth went dry. Sheldon feathered up to the hangar and hopped out. The plane was empty, and water still dripped from the skis. He had done it. Sheldon explained, "No sweat. It's a beautiful day up there. I did have a little trouble seeing the glacier's surface, though. We'll take some more spruce branches on the second flight. I'll be back in 10 minutes." After carefully folding myself into the tiny airplane and piling extra gear around me, my stomach acted up again. I groaned, "Oh no, not again, not in the plane." Mike ran up with starting line fever, thrust a bottle of Pepto-Bismol into my hand, and hollered, "Here, take this. I know just how you feel, buddy. You gotta hold it in, Jerry." I chugged some of the pink liquid, burped badly, and just barely managed to retain my stomach's contents. Part 4. Welcome to the Kahiltna. Sheldon strapped our sled to the wing strut, mumbling, "I don't like the looks of this contraption. Betcha it'll screw up the Cub's lift." I insisted, "We need the sled, Don. After this 5-day storm, we've got to make up for lost time, and we need the sled to do that." Finally, with a wad of spruce branches in my face, we accelerated down the runway with Sheldon bellowing over the engine's scream, "Blast off!" I kept the Pepto-Bismol handy. We lifted off, turned over the Susitna River, and headed for the mountain. I couldn't converse with Sheldon over the engine's noise, so I just sniffed the spruce branches and marveled at the Alaskan scenery. Below was a huge carpet of spruce trees reflected 1,000 subtle shades as streams meandered through numerous small lakes. I thought about all the mosquitoes that must be down there. We passed wooded lowlands, flew over the Peters Hills, and left the last green behind as we flew into the foothills of the Alaska Range. I would not see green plants again until I left the mountain. Sheldon circled once to gain elevation, then flew toward a narrow mountain cirque. I had assumed that we would fly up the Kahiltna Glacier from its snout and wondered where Sheldon was going. Straining for a view, I pushed the spruce branches aside. There was a pass ahead of us, but it was much higher than we were. Suddenly, Sheldon turned the Cub and headed west, away from the cirque. Sheldon summed it up with, "That pass is a one-shot deal, no second chance, no nothing." Then he pointed accusingly at our sled on the strut and hollered, "That's eating my lift. Gotta go the long way." Suddenly, the mountains of Little Switzerland surrounded us. These rugged peaks are not high by Denali standards, but my eyes still bugged out at all the ridges and faces. My mind couldn't process all the routes that we flew quickly past, but the sensory overload was grand. Then we were over the Kahiltna Glacier, a prodigious river of ice that provides access to Denali through the lower peaks. Sheldon started pumping hard on a handle, and I realized he was lowering the skis. We looked out to verify that the skis were both down and locked in position. As we slowly gained altitude, the glacier rose up to meet us. Ahead, I saw a large icefall full of crevasses. We were too low to clear it, and Sheldon circled to gain elevation. At first, I worried that he wouldn't be able to turn the plane around in the valley, but this turned out to be a silly fear, since the glacier is 3 miles wide, and Sheldon turned this tiny Cub in a few hundred yards. He aimed straight at the mountain wall, enjoying the scenery, then turned for another view. After 2 complete circles, we still didn't have enough altitude to clear the icefall. As Sheldon banked for a 3rd circle, he turned to me, pointed hard at the sled on the wing strut, and thundered, "She won't climb!" I felt guilty for insisting on the stupid sled, but said nothing. After 4 circles, we made it up over the icefall. The snow was whiter up here, and the peaks near the glacier no longer looked like foothills, but huge mountains. Straining, I saw Mount Foraker and Mount Hunter standing guard on opposite sides of the glacier. These 2 peaks are the next highest peaks in the Alaska Range after Denali. I couldn't see their summits from the Cub's cramped interior, but knew that there would be plenty of time for oogling the view later. I also knew that the landing site was just south of the National Park boundary, on the Kahiltna's southeast fork below Mount Hunter. We were almost there! Turning, the cub nosed up the southeast fork, and suddenly I saw Joff running on the snow below us. He already had a tent pitched, and I saw ski tracks from the cub's first landing. We barely saw Joff's spruce branches on the snow, so Sheldon swooped low over the landing site several times, eyeing it carefully. When we came close to the glacier surface, the cub seemed to be going fearfully fast. Sheldon pulled up and gave me our prearranged signal to prepare the spruce branches for pitching. Sheldon lined up for a pass over the runway and opened the door. An icy blast hit me like a piton hammer, so I gripped the branches tightly to keep them from ripping out of my hands. When Sheldon's hand dropped, I heard him holler, "Bombs away!" I popped the branches out one or two at a time as fast as I could. He raised his hand to wave me off, and I stopped throwing. After we repeated the process, we saw a neat line of dark spots along the runway. Our awkward sled on the strut still worried Sheldon, so we prepared to drop several 5-gallon food cans to lighten the aircraft. Our timing on these drops was critical, since this was our food. If I mistimed the drop, the food could land in a crevasse, far from camp, or worse, hit the tent or even Joff. Also, I had to propel each 20-pound can cleanly downward so that it would not hit the plane's tail. We had attached long, colorful streamers to our cans so we could find them after they fell into the deep snow. However, at launch time, the streamers had to be tidy so they wouldn't catch on anything in the plane. This was not a time to enjoy the view, and as Sheldon banked hard, I struggled to get the first can ready. Sheldon lined up on the drop zone, then raised his hand in the ready position. Ignoring the wind, I clamped the streamer on the can and held it out the open door. I grimly hung on until I heard Sheldon bellowing in a huge voice, "Ready! Drop!" I pushed the can down clean and hard. Where it fell, I knew not, but my job was to get them out clean, since Sheldon did the aiming. I had 4 food cans, so we repeated the process 3 more times. They were all clean drops. When Sheldon banked hard after each drop, I saw Joff running near the tent. We made 1 more pass, and I pitched out 3 bundles of wands that we would use later for marking our trail. The plane was now 100 pounds lighter, and this was a significant saving, since the cub's empty weight was only 1,000 pounds. Finally, Sheldon lined up for the landing. He kept the engine RPMs high, and the cub seemed impossibly fast as we approached the sloping glacier. He feathered the engine slightly, then put the nose up until I could no longer see the glacier ahead. Sheldon couldn't see it either, so he looked out the side window and watched the snow come up to meet the skis. The skis touched the snow with a metallic hiss, and we slid up the glacier. Sheldon revved the engine, kicked hard on the left rudder, and maneuvered the cub to a stop in a sideways position in preparation for takeoff. He hit the master switch, shut down the engine, and popped open the door. My Pepto-Bismol immediately fell out onto the snow, while Joff sprinted up and hollered, "Welcome to the Kahilna!" I staggered out on shaky legs and mustered my best war cry, "Summit Club climbs these mountain!" By the time Mike and Dick landed, Joff and I had a better runway stomped out and a decent camp pitched. Without the sled, Sheldon had no trouble with the other landings. And 14 hours after Joff had blasted off from Talkeetna, we were all on the glacier. As Sheldon prepared to leave for the last time, he looked around at the mountains, the weather, the sky, then offered us his advice for climbing Denali. With his hand on the cub's door, he said, "When the weather clobbers up, dig in and hunker down. When she clears up, go like a jackrabbit." Sheldon pulled up into the cub, strapped himself in, and fired the engine. While we pushed on the wing struts to get him going, he flapped the rudder and ailerons like crazy to pop the tail wheel out of the snow. As he started his takeoff run, we ran along through the deep snow, pushing as long as we could. Then at the last moment, we jumped to the side so the tail wouldn't hit us. The track team gave Sheldon his best push ever. Sheldon's cub roared down the glacier in a prodigious cloud of blowing snow, lifted off, banked left, and quickly disappeared. The engine sound echoed off the mountain walls for another minute. Then it was very still. The only sound was our breathing as we lay panting on the snow. We were finally here, and we were alone. Suddenly, our pile of used equipment looked very small. An imposing mountain vista surrounded us, and as we took stock of our position, we realized that none of us had ever been in such a beautiful place. We were at 7,300 feet, and Mount Hunter's 14,573-foot summit was only 2 miles away. The original Indian name for Hunter is Bhagaya, meaning Denali's child. Hunter's north face rose abruptly from the Kehiltna's southeast fork in a sweep of rock, snow, and ice that we could not comprehend. The face rose well over a vertical mile at an average angle of 48 degrees. As we stared up in awe, a huge avalanche swept down the face, then ravaged the upper southeast fork. We were safe at the landing site, but an instinctive fear tugged at us. If this giant was the child, what would Denali look like? The main Kehiltna Glacier was a mile away down the southeast fork, and we gawked across the great river of ice. What a view! Mount Foraker soared above the far side of the Kehiltna, rising from 6,700 feet to 17,400 feet, a difference of over 2 vertical miles. Foraker's summit was almost 8 miles away, but the peak seemed impossibly close, huge, and beautiful. Staring, I knew that Foraker was the most beautiful mountain that I had ever seen. The original Indian name for Foraker is Sultana, meaning Denali's queen. For our stay in this white wilderness, Foraker was my fairy queen, and I gazed at her, trying to understand. While Hunter inspired neck-bending awe and fear, Foraker transmitted beauty, power, and a regal grace. I immediately rejected all thoughts of ever climbing Hunter. However, even in 1963, I found myself eyeing Foraker looking for routes. Even without having seen the mountain, Denali's greatness started to touch me. I felt that this special place was a womb between mother and child, a place of fertility and regeneration. Looking around, I knew that in this physically sterile land, the gift of life is given to the spirit of those who come here. However, we had not come here to climb Hunter or Foraker. Where was Denali, the Great One? We looked toward Denali, but lingering clouds covered the intervening ridges, and we could not see him. Later that evening, the temperature plummeted, the clouds dissipated, and Denali appeared. Soft shades simmered across the gulf between the aloof summit, and as we stared in silence, we quickly grasped that Denali was farther, colder, higher, and larger than either Hunter or Foraker, and that Denali would not so easily reveal his secret splendors. Denali's summit was more than 8 air miles from where we stood, but air miles only have meaning for pilots in this serrated vastness. We were now on foot, and our climbing route would require 17 horizontal miles, almost 3 vertical miles, and all our resources. My Pepto-Bismol froze during the first night, but it didn't matter, since I would not need it again now that I was in the mountains.